Welcome back to Eco Talk, and it is my great pleasure and honor, really, to introduce one of the people who has most inspired me, and that is Ray Anderson. For those of you who have not heard him speak, you are in for a treat. He founded a carpet company called Interface 32 years ago. He is now the CEO and chairman, and he's done some amazing things. Not only is Interface the largest commercial carpet manufacturer in the world, they're headquartered in Atlanta. Interface has manufacturing locations, I should say, in four continents, offices in more than 100 countries. And if that's not impressive enough, and you might wonder, you know, how someone who's as big a manufacturer of textiles, carpets no less, could possibly be a pioneer in the sustainability movement. But both exist in the form of Ray Anderson. He has brought Interface a reputation as a corporation carrying the banner for our environment. He speaks around the country and around the world, and every time people give him a standing ovation. And the first time I heard Ray speak about 5-6 years ago at a conference, I happened to have my daughter, Jenna, with me. She was 4 or 5. And she, so help me God, when Ray read his poem at the end of the talk, and I hope he'll include that at the end of our show, she stood up on a chair and applauded as if she understood. Maybe she did. So, Ray, thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here, Betsy.
For those who have not read your book, Mid-Course Correction, or heard your story, take us back and tell us about your eco-epiphany. I'm working on a book on eco-awakenings, and I think you have the ultimate one. And it came from a book that is called The Ecology of Commerce, as I recall.
Right, by an author right there in San Francisco.
Oh, well, a lot of great pioneers are here, most of them, except for you, you're in Atlanta, which, by the way, is my home state.
Well, it came about this way, Betsy. Interface is, as you said, 32 years old, and for the first 21 years of our existence, I'd have to admit I never gave a thought to what we were taking from the earth or doing to the earth in the producing of our products, carpets, carpet tiles, textile fabrics, and so forth. And then in the summer of 1994, just almost 11 years ago now, we began to hear a strange new question coming from interior designers and architects, people who were developing the specifications for the carpet that would be going into this building or that building, our marketplaces, the commercial and institutional marketplace, offices, hospitals, schools, airports, and so on and so forth, places where people work, not so much places where people live, though in recent days we've introduced residential carpet tiles as well and residential bottling carpet. But back in those days, it was strictly commercial. And the commercial interior designers began to ask this question, what's your company doing for the environment? And we really had no answers. And our salespeople were struggling with this because and began to beg, actually, for answers. What are we doing? What are our environmental policies? So two of my managers came to me one day and said, look, our salespeople insisting we've got to get some answers. Why don't we put together a task force, bring people together from around the world, and assess our company's environmental position and begin to frame some answers? And I said, sure, go for it. Sounds good. And then they said, yeah, but we want you to come and address this task force and give them the kickoff speech and launch this new task force with your environmental vision. Well, I didn't have an environmental vision. I didn't want to make that speech. I drug my feet. I finally relented, and then I started to sweat what to say. And I could not get beyond we obey the law, comply. And while I was in the midst of really sweating over that, I knew comply was not a vision. A book landed on my desk. It was Paul Hawkins' book, The Ecology of Commerce, and I picked it up without any idea what was in it, and I began to thumb it. And I came to a chapter heading, The Death of Birth. And I began to read, and it became very quickly a spear in the chest for me, an epiphanal experience. I encountered terms I had never seen before in one paragraph. Terms like carrying capacity, overshoot, collapse, and of course extinction, the death of birth, species disappearing, never ever to be born again. And it was an epiphanal moment, and I realized it was an eye-opening moment. I realized I was a plunderer of the earth. Paul made his central thesis in three parts. First, the living systems of Earth, the life support systems, the biosphere itself is in decline, long-term systemic decline. And the biggest culprit in that is the industrial system, the take, make, waste, linear industrial system driven by fossil fuel-derived energy, wasteful, abusive, focused on labor productivity, more stuff per man hour. And then he makes his really telling point, which is the only institution on Earth that's large enough and powerful enough, pervasive enough, wealthy enough, influential enough to lead humankind out of the mess it's making for itself is the very institution doing the most damage, the institution of business and industry.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you. Before you begin to tell us about your turnaround, we're going to have to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to hear how Ray Anderson, head of Interface Carpet, went from wondering how he was going to be able to comply with environmental regulations to becoming a champion of corporate sustainability. You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio. Visit our blog site, by the way, at www.ecotalkblog.com. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute or two.
If you've
That's our theme song, Ray, as you probably tell. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. I thought you in particular would appreciate that. You there, Ray?
I'm here.
Okay, good. When we left off before the break, you were telling us about your eco U-turn, how you went from being a self-admitted plunderer of the earth to leading a company that is seen as foremost in industrial ecology. So continue on with your story.
Sure. Well, as I was saying, Paul Hawkins' central points in three parts. The third being that the only institution on Earth large enough and powerful enough, pervasive enough, wealthy enough, influential enough to really lead humankind out of the mess it's making for itself is the same institution doing the greatest damage, the institution of business and industry, my institution. I took that very personally, and I made that speech to that little task force using Paul Hawkins' material shamelessly, I might say, and it just stunned them. And, of course, it shocked me, too. And I challenged that little group to lead our company to sustainability and beyond, to become a restorative company. I said, you know, unless somebody leads, nobody will. It's axiomatic. You know, why not us? And for now, nearly 11 years, we've been on this mountain climbing experience, climbing Mount Sustainability. And I'm telling you, it's a very, very high mountain. But we're making progress, and we're getting on up that mountain, maybe a third of the way from where we were to where we want to be, the top of the mountain, that point at the top symbolizing zero environmental footprint, zero impact. That's really the goal to which we aspire.
Now, before we get into some of your particular programs and goals, it wasn't all smooth sailing. It took a lot of bumps in the road, I know, because I've heard your story a few times.
Well, sure. I mean, we began not having a clue what it all really meant. We had to, first of all, understand what sustainability really was. And in a petro-intensive company like ours, yeah, it means eventually figuring out how to sever the umbilical cord to Earth, the one through which oil flows, by the way, to provide the petrochemically derived materials as well as the energy that drives our production processes. That's a very tall order. The technologies did not exist when we began. one by one over the 10-year period now, they've begun to fall into place. But the more difficult ones still lie ahead of us, yet to be solved. But we're committed to the top of that mountain by the year 2020. And our people are working every day in hundreds and hundreds of projects all through our company, plugging away up that mountain towards that zero footprint. We began without a plan, and we spent a year figuring out how to climb that mountain, and we finally identified the seven faces of the mountain, and we know there's an eighth one, you know, we haven't figured out yet, bound to be. But the seven faces of the mountain are there, and we've got them defined, and we've got our metrics so we can measure our progress, and we climb away. I'll be happy to tell you what those seven faces are if and when you have time.
Yes, I hope we get to that. But first I want to sort of get down on the carpet, if you will, and talk about what you make. You make rugs that not only have real upstream impact but can downstream as well. I imagine that traditional carpeting is not so biodegradable, and that when, you know, many people were replacing their carpets, you know, industrially, you know, residentially, commercially, the entire carpet's ripped out, sent to a landfill where it will be there forever. Fill us in on what the process was and what you've done to really revolutionize that.
Right. In America, most carpet today is synthetic. That is, the face material is synthetic. It's very little natural fiber used in the United States. And in fact, around the world, it's diminished almost to nothing. So it's synthetics everywhere, which means nylon. Nylon carpet in a landfill will be there fully 20,000 years, maybe more, before it finally degrades. So we're petrochemically intensive, meaning that the materials come from oil or natural gas, fossil fuels in one form or another. And it's an energy-intensive operation. It certainly was more so when we began. A lot of our processes were wet processes, that is to say, requiring water and the drying and the energy intensity that goes with driving water out of a product. Chemicals used for dyeing and imparting color and design to the carpet. And lots of abusive processes, smokestacks everywhere. We counted the smokestacks in our company. We found 282 smokestacks. And one of our faces of the mountain is benign emissions. That is to be sure that whatever we do emit is benign and harmless to the biosphere. And one of the ways we track our progress on that face of the mountain is by how many smokestacks we've closed down, eliminated, obviated. And we're making terrific progress on that front. Not only smokestacks, but effluent pipes and solid waste to the landfill. All of those are opportunities, and, you know, waste is money. And we've been able to save a lot of money through the waste elimination
process. Now, Ray, did you actually invent carpet tiles, the concept of just taking out a part of a carpet and replacing it?
Carpet tiles were invented in Europe. Today we own the company, the Dutch company that invented carpet tiles. But before we owned that company through an acquisition, we brought carpet tile technology from Europe to the United States, and we made the first free-lay carpet tiles in America. And we actually patented the process and the product, the free-lay carpet tile. The patents have long since expired. But we've built a business based on that unique technology. Carpet tiles found their place in the American marketplace in the early 80s, as so many buildings were being built with in-floor electrical distribution systems, that Broadloom carpet very quickly got cut to pieces.
So is that the standard now, or is that the exception, carpet tiles?
Well, it's been a growing transformation from a Broadloom-dominated industry to a carpet tile industry. And in the commercial sector, we're approaching 50-50 now. Carpet tiles have come from nothing to close to 50% of that marketplace in the 30 years or so that we've been at it.
So specifically in layman's terms, Ray, what happens to carpet tiles when it's removed by interface and traditionally how it's removed perhaps still by other companies?
When Broadloom carpet came off the floor years ago, after a very short life, because as soon as you get damage in one area, the whole thing has to go. So a big spill, indelible spill, means the whole carpet gets replaced.
Yeah, terribly wasteful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it used to go to a landfill and where it would reside for the next 20,000 years.
Or
and,
so.
But with carpet tiles, first of all, you extend the useful life of the product because you can make selective replacement. You get a spill here, you replace a tile or two. You get some damage or worn area there, you replace a few tiles. And as the design of the products, the face design, the patterns and design have improved, you can today you can really replace those individual tiles without the new one standing out like a sore thumb. So you extend the useful life of the product. That's the first environmentally sensitive thing, to get a longer life out of the petrochemical materials that you've used in the first place. But with carpet tiles and the technologies that we've developed for the backing material that keeps the carpet tile on the floor, that was our first focus, how to recycle that backing material, because it's petrochemically rich and intensive and energy intensive. So we focus there, and we have today learned to recycle the carpet tile back. And we're looking for carpet tiles that have, you know, fulfill their useful life, that we can bring back, salvage the backing material, put it into a closed-loop material flows, and produce the recycled carpet tile back in as good as virgin material.
Wow. And are you able to do that with 100% of your product, or about what percentage?
We're able to do it with 100% of the carpet tiles, but carpet tiles are not the entire product line of our company. We have a textile business, a pretty substantial one that's making the fabrics that go into office furniture, the panel fabrics, the seating fabrics. And most of that today is produced from recycled PET. That's, you know, the clear Coke bottle or water bottle.
The stuff that does not biodegrade naturally.
It would not biodegrade, and, you know, again, for a very long time. So the recycling systems have been created to convert water bottles to textile fiber. And we're using those recycled bottles in textile fiber. And you cannot see you cannot tell the difference between the virgin polyester and the recycled polyester PET. It's a wonderful product, and it has taken the market in the commercial office furniture industry. The so-called TerraTex product, that's what we call it, has gained very quick acceptance because interior designers prefer recycled products. It's amazing.
Ray, we have less than a minute before our next break. One more segment to go with you, and I want to, in the last one, get to how you are actually not just walking the EcoTalk, but talking the EcoTalk and speaking to CEOs around the world. But are other carpet companies following in your recycling footsteps? Is that now really being introduced into the mainstream textile manufacturers?
That's when we set out to become a restorative company. We said the only way that happens really is through the power of influence. If we influence other companies to move this way, we become restorative, putting back more than we take, and we take doing good for Earth, not just no harm. And it has happened. Everyone has moved in some way or another, some more than others, some with narrow focus, others with, you know, different focus, but one way or another.
Hold that thought, Ray. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to EcoTalk on Air America Radio. Talk, where we're taking our heads out of the sand one show at a time, and quite definitely in this particular interview with Ray Anderson, who is a pioneer in the carpeting textile industry. But not just that. He's really taken the concepts behind Interface Carpet on the road, travels extensively, speaking to CEOs. And, Ray, my first question in this segment is how are you received? Do you always have the same kind of response you do when you speak to environmental crowds, or is there some resistance? What do you see on the faces of people who are hearing this kind of conversation perhaps for the first time?
Well, Betsy, there's a groundswell. You know, I've never sought the first invitation to speak. People keep finding me, and it's happening at the rate of 80 and 90 speeches a year, and I try not to say no. So I find myself going to a lot of places. And more recently, most recently, I'd say more and more business interest and interest in the educational community, too, which is enormously encouraging. Our educational system, frankly, is part of our problem. And the educational community, particularly higher education, is listening and beginning to make its own transformation and looking at those obsolete curricula that are teaching internal combustion engines rather than fuel cells, for example. So the audiences are, frankly, always receptive because they've sought me out in the first place. I've never imposed myself anywhere that I wasn't wanted. So it's encouraging, though, that business is more and more taking that initiative. I think if business doesn't come aboard, frankly, it's over for humankind.
Now, of course, business is always interested in the bottom line. What do you say in terms of what this cost interface, cost-benefit analysis, where does it come out?
Betsy, it is a better way to bigger profits. In our experience now, 10 years of it, our costs are down, not up. We have saved in the waste category alone $255 million over these years, and that's a company that with sales about $1 billion per year. So the $255 million is a big percentage of our bottom line. It's come from waste elimination. Our products are better than they've ever been, and that's come about because our product designers have taken inspiration from biomimicry. You know Janine Benyus's work in documenting the biomimetic activities around the country. Our product designer has taken hold of biomimicry and has designed products that emulate nature, and they're the best they've ever been. And the reception from the marketplace, the goodwill in the marketplace, has been nothing less than astounding. Those same people who were asking us 10, 11 years ago, what's your company doing for the environment, have embraced what we do. And the goodwill exceeds what any amount of advertising could possibly have generated. And it's genuine. You know, the goodwill is based on the fact that our people at the factory floor are doing this stuff and moving up that mountain. And finally, our people themselves are galvanized around this higher purpose. Maslow had it right years ago when he talked about his hierarchy of human needs, and this need to be identified with a higher purpose is right at the very top of that hierarchy. And it has a marvelous galvanizing effect as people see that they're part of something bigger than themselves.
Anyway, we just
setting
have a
an example.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last thing.
Setting an example.
And you have a vision of a world of sustainable prosperity without industrial pollution. Is that realistic in the foreseeable future? And if so, what would you like all Americans to take away from this interview? What can they think about and do to move us in that direction faster?
Betsy, I saw a wonderful quotation the other day. History has not treated the impossible very kindly. When you say something's impossible, you know, history, it doesn't take long for history to prove that the impossible really was possible all along. And if we're an example of anything, it is an example of the power of the marketplace, the power of the people. Those customers who were asking those questions 11 years ago gave the whole process its initial impetus. And here we go. And it can be done. It is possible. As Amory Lovin says, if it exists, it must be possible. So we're trying to show that it can exist. And by 2020, I think we'll have that example.
We have exactly 2 minutes left, Ray. Can you read Tomorrow's Child in that time? Or is that?
Oh, my, yeah, I can do it.
Go for it.
One of our people heard me speak. I didn't know in the early days whether I was connecting or not. But when he composed a poem after our morning together and sent it to me by email And I saw it. It was one of the most uplifting moments of my life. It told me, by golly, one person got it. The poem was entitled Tomorrow's Child. Without a name, an unseen face, and knowing not your time or place, tomorrow's child, though yet unborn, I met you first last Tuesday morn. A wise friend introduced us to, and through his sobering point of view, I saw a day that you would see, a day for you, but not for me. Knowing you has changed my thinking, for I never had an inkling that perhaps the things I do might someday somehow threaten you. Tomorrow's child, my daughter's son, I'm afraid I've just begun to think of you and of your good, though always having known I should. Began I will to weigh the cost of what I squander, what is lost, if ever I forget that you will someday come and live here too.
That's the one that brought my five-year-old to her feet. She was clapping when she heard that, as if she understood who you were fighting for, tomorrow's children and beyond. Ray Anderson has been recognized as the greenest chief executive in America. That must feel pretty good, Ray. We have 30 seconds left.
Well, it's our people who are doing this. Bessie, I could talk to them. I was blue in the face. Somebody said nobody makes a reputation talking about what they're going to do. It's our people.
You got to do it.
It's our people that are doing it.
And quickly, just give us the title of your book and a website. People want to find out more about your work.
Our website is interfaceinc.com. And you can go straight to interfacesustainability.com, and you'll see about 400 pages of absolute transparency as we report the progress we're making to climb and mount sustainability.
Well, good luck on that climb. The book, one of them anyway, is Mid-Course Correction by Ray Anderson. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer?
If you've recently...